Like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order, please.
No idea what that meant.
Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, February 11th. We will be having a couple public hearings today. We have House Bill 2301, House Bill 2307, and House Bill 2190. And we are going to start committee with House Bill 2301. We'll be going according to the agenda as printed, which makes my committee administrator happy. So, with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2301. And Victoria, would you give us a brief description of our first bill?
Happy to. House Bill 2301 raises the allowable fee for a dishonored check from $25 to $35.
That was short. To the point. And signed up is Jim Marquis. I believe the sponsor of this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. House Bill 2301 is a very straightforward and fairly simple bill. It proposes to change ORS 30.701 sub 5, which presently allows the payee of a dishonored check to collect from the maker a fee. The present statute allows a fee not to exceed $25. And the bill proposes to change that amount to $35. This is a kind of a fee that is normally charged by a retailer. They are required to post a sign in their establishment saying that if they get a dishonored check, that they're going to charge this fee. Presently, the limit is $25, and we propose to take it to $35. This statute was enacted in 1981, and when it was enacted in 1981, the amount in the bill was $25, and it has been $25 for 28 years. So we're proposing a 29% increase. Compare that to the consumer price index since 1981, you're looking at 90.7%. So pretty straightforward. Be happy to answer any questions. We support the bill and would urge its passage.
Questions from the committee? Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give me some idea of why this particular amount? I'll tell you what my concern is that the individual against whom this would be charged are probably the ones that are having the most difficult time making it in our world right now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, I understand your concern. It is against the law to write a bad check. And, we try to encourage people not to do that, and this is a small way that we do that. And I understand your concern, though.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any data on, what it actually costs the retailer or whoever gets these checks to deal with it?
Representative Hovey, Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, substantially more than the $35 is the answer.
Okay.
Because in many cases, I shouldn't say in all cases, but in many cases, because oftentimes the retailer who takes that check and deposits it in good faith into his bank account is charged a fee by the bank for depositing a check that wasn't good. And so by the time he pays that and the other costs involved, these become quite expensive for folks in the retail sector.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, I shared Representative Cowan's concern in these times. And, of course, the converse of that is in these times, with the kind of cost that you just quoted to Representative Riley, it also hurts our small business owners. So this is pretty subjective. I don't know how you tell what person's motive is. But generally speaking, are we and when we have an increase in the state of Oregon of bad checks, are we talking people who are dishonest or people who are disorganized?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I don't think there's any way for me to answer that question. I think it's, you know, I mean, it's probably a mix of from one end of the spectrum to the other, you know. But I do think that small businesses who are really the victims of this kind of conduct are probably hurting right now more than anybody in our society. So,
thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Chair. Question, or my question is, do you know the fees that the small businesses, the average fee that they're assessed when they take a check in and it does not clear? Because I think there is a fee that they pay when they deposit a check and it doesn't clear.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, that fee is going to vary depending upon what financial institution they're dealing with, and I think those fees are subject to between the business and the financial institution, so it's going to vary depending upon what financial institution they're dealing with, and I really don't know what those fees, I mean, I don't know what the range of those fees is. I could certainly get that information for you if it's something you'd like. But
follow up?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Because I think, I mean, not that the fee's excessive or anything like that, but I think we probably should weigh everything out when we're doing this or get ready to do it, because I know he's charged a fee from his bank when he bounces a check, and the person who tried depositing the check is charged a fee as well. And I think those are up at $25, $35 on their side, so I think it'd be worth investigating a little bit before we attack this so we make sure we do things right to protect the guy who's cashing the bounce check. So if we can make him come out clean, that's the only thing I would be interested in doing. So.
Thank you. Jim, is there any relationship in law or any other relationship that you know of that between the bank charges to the customer when they receive a bad check as opposed to this statute, which allows somebody to go after the maker of a bad check?
Well, ORS 30.701 covers what a retailer or a payee on a negotiable instrument can do to collect from the maker of that check or that negotiable instrument. And that's really the only statute that we have that deals with the recourse of action or the course of action available to a payee on one of these negotiable instruments. So that statute doesn't speak at all to the other kinds of things that you're talking about here with respect to financial institutions. So this is sort of unrelated. While I understand that they're related in the sense of looking at this perhaps more globally, like Representative Widener wanted to do, anything you did in that, I don't think comes under this statute.
So. Right, and that was the answer I was looking for. So there really isn't a statutory relationship or a legal relationship between this fee and the fee that a bank charges its customer when they receive a bad check.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Representative Wingard.
Jim, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've already managed to figure out this isn't about what the bank charges. So who are we talking about here? Who are we talking about? Just any retailer, anybody, the dry cleaner, anybody who accepts a check? I wasn't aware that we had a law that limited what they could charge as a fee. So this applies to literally anybody in business who accepts a check?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, yes, that's correct. This does apply to anyone, not only in business, and just anyone who accepts a check. Yes. So this statute was put on the books in 1981 by this body to allow retailers to charge something when they get one of these checks, because it does cost them something. So
follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's been my observation that most businesses don't accept checks, or a lot of them don't, and that of those that do, they're using some kind of a check verification system where they're running it through it. I'm going to sound like a real layman here because I didn't invent the machine and I don't use it, but it does some kind of a bank account verification, which I assume they're paying for that service to essentially inoculate them against taking in a check that would bounce. So I guess my question is, who is this bill aimed at? Who is still accepting checks without verifying them that would want to be able to levy this fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, very small retailers.
For instance?
Representative Widener is pointing at himself. There are lots of people that don't subscribe to check verification programs. So, I mean, most grocery stores do and others do. But and still, there's still some possibility that you'll get an insufficient funds check. So even if you do that. So.
Jim, can you tell me, how would a person go about collecting that fee? I mean, you're coming from the collection agency, but it seems like the collection agency, this would be a pretty small amount of money that a collection agency, I don't know, they'd be able to actually collect the fee for somebody. Maybe they do.
Mr. Chair, actually, some of these do get referred to collection agencies, and some of them do simply charge they take the $25 that we'll collect that, and you give us the $25 that you are entitled to. What happens if the maker of the check doesn't pay? At some point after notification, and it's also covered under this statute, they can be sued under this statute, and the damages are treble damages. But at that point, if you choose to do that, you have to waive the $25. But so this legislature decided many years ago that this was a serious enough thing that people should be subject to treble damages when they write a check and then don't make it good. So this, in some ways, we've had many of our clients who are interested in preventing people from allowing these things to go further. So I hope that answered your question.
Close enough, I guess. It's probably more questions than you ever envisioned on this bill.
Mr. Chair, I can tell it's February and not April.
That's right.
Yeah, so can I. Further questions? Not seeing any. I appreciate the testimony
Chair.
Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2301? Seeing no one else, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2301 and open a hearing on House Bill 2307. Victoria, will you give us a brief description of 2307, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2307 creates an exception to the definition of collection agency for a person that receives an assignment of debt without obligation to pay the assigner any of the proceeds resulting from collection of the debt.
Thank you. And we have signed up Kim.
Good afternoon, Chairman. It's Kim Sugawa Fujinaga. And I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Debtor Creditor Collection Committee, Legislative Committee. And usually I would stand on my testimony, but I understand you likely have not received my testimony yet, so I will give a brief overview. I am a practitioner in Portland. I am an associate at Green & Markley. We primarily do collection, debtor-creditor work. I mostly do creditor work and also bankruptcy. But I'm appearing for you today on behalf of the Debtor-Creditor Legislative Committee. The purpose of this bill is to address problems affecting outright debt buyers, specifically for true assignments. As the statute is written now, that would be Chapter 697. The definition of collection agency is very broad. And basically, there have been a couple of bankruptcy cases that have come down and also cases that were followed up with the U.S. District Court where parties that received true assignments have been designated as collection agencies, and therefore, if they did not register with the Department of, I think it's Business and Finance, requiring not only registration fees and a $10,000 bond, that they were not allowed to have standing to pursue legal matters because of their failure to register. And so because of that problem, the committee decided to request an amendment to define or redefine and create an exception to the statute that is currently written to exclude outright assignments from the definition of collection agencies. It seems simple, but I'm sure it's not. I'm sure there are many questions.
That was a short description of your bill. I think it was relatively accurate. Questions?
Still reading, Mr. Chair.
Still reading, trying to digest this a little bit.
Sure.
It's an issue that perhaps that many of us have not really encountered. So I'm going to ask you a question specifically about what it is that has happened. From my understanding, you've been in court and the courts have determined that you're a collection agency, and you're not registered, so you have no standing in court?
Let me just clarify that. That's a few cases that I have found, but personally, in my practice, what I have found is I've had situations where, for example, I've had a client who got involved in lending some money to someone, and it turned out to be sort of like a scam. And unfortunately, my client had gotten other members of his family to do the same thing. So this was a fairly large amount of money, almost $500,000. What had happened was, in his remorse, he wanted to go ahead and pursue litigation, but take over the claims from the other family members. And so what he did was he got a true assignment from those family members to pursue those claims on their behalf. And one of the concerns that we had, or that I had when that came up, was that he would be considered under the broad definition as a collection agency, which would require him theoretically to post the $10,000 bond and also to register with the Department of Business and Finance. And that, to me, does not seem to be what the statute and the act was intended to encompass, somebody of that nature. When I had done further case law research, it wasn't my case, but I have found other cases with Judge Radcliffe, and also that case was followed up by Judge Aiken, where the district court did find a case where there was someone who was taking a true assignment of claims, who bought those claims outright from another entity and attempted to enforce a claim in bankruptcy court. and Judge Radcliffe essentially found that because the person who had bought the claims had not registered as a collection agency, that they were barred from bringing action on that particular claim in bankruptcy because that person had not paid the $10,000 bond and also not registered with the department. I've read through Mr. Baxter's testimony, and I know he has concerns about the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. There's nothing in this particular bill which proposes an amendment to 646 as far as if it has any legal effect. That's not something that I believe the committee considered. If that is a concern, I don't believe the bill as written now has any effect on the remedies of a creditor. Of course, under federal law, it doesn't have any effect. Under the Oregon law, it's not amending that particular section and act. So I don't believe as it's written that it would affect the Oregon Unlawful Practices Act.
So I'm going to ask next. So when in reading the bill, this is I guess the common referral is this bill is about debt buyers who buy debt and then try to collect the debt. And so what you're saying is when they do that, they're not a collection agency because now the debt is theirs because they bought it.
That's correct. You
and
own
so,
it.
And so they're a first-party debt collector, not the third-party debt collector that is common in their collection agency definition.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winger.
I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to wade in here and with a question. What would be I heard your scenario of an individual had family members, but if I were a collection agency, or whatever I want to call myself, and I didn't have that arrangement where I'm going to collect and give a piece back to the person, I just bought, in other words, I bought for 10 cents on the dollar debts outright from people like Mr. Marquis's clients, you know, retailers who have debt, I just buy them up. How am I different in your scenario than that guy who bought up his family member's debts? I mean, I now own those debts, but I'm essentially a debt collector, right? I mean, because I'm a collection agency because I'm going to go after these folks for collection on that debt I just bought up, right?
Sure, and Chair Representative Wingard has asked me the question about, from what I'm understanding, it sounds like the scenario you're posting is that where you are a collection agency, you're saying that this is your ordinary course of business, that you go ahead and you go out and you purchase these debts. I assume you're talking about consumer debt, because under the Oregon Act, as far as I understand it, that regulates consumer debt. And so as far as family members go, I believe the Oregon Act doesn't necessarily include, and I have not reviewed 646, so I'm not an expert on it, but as far as I recall, 646 doesn't include, for example, collections between family members or neighbors. It solely has to be someone who is in the ordinary course of business. That is their business of collecting consumer debt. So that would be your scenario that you were talking about versus the scenario I was talking about. You're right. It is a little gray. I'm not sure where the difference would be under the 697 definition, but under, I believe, the Oregon Act, there is a difference. I don't know if that answers your question.
So I remain completely confused, but that's probably just me.
I believe that is one of the issues. When I had this issue before we attempted to draft the bill, I did talk at length with an analyst at Business and Finance, and she has been on this statute for, she has a binder that is just enormous, and she has every amendment that's ever happened since the act was enacted, and she says this is a recurring problem, that 697, which is geared towards the department's regulation of collection agencies and their customers, gets sort of muddled up with everyone, the idea behind protecting consumers under 646 and the federal debt Collection Practices Act. They are statutes with very different purposes.
So I got to get something out here before I move on to somebody else's question. So a collection agency falls under the Debt Collections Practices Act. And so are there any regulations or practices, laws that the first party collector in this case, the debt buyer, falls under as far under Oregon statutes?
Well, I do believe that the federal only regulates third party collectors, and I understand that the Oregon Act is a little bit broader, that it does regulate first tier collections, but it has to be collections of a particular kind. I think it has to specifically be consumer protection or consumer related transactions, and so that particular scenario is covered, and the remedies that are available to the consumer that would remain in 646. I don't necessarily know if changing the definition of collection agencies as far as 697 regulating the relationship between the collection agency and the customer who had the original debt. I don't know if that definition would affect, in fact, it shouldn't affect the remedies that are available in 646. No.
but the question though is more, I guess, to the point of what protections are there for consumers in facing a third party collector as opposed to a first party collector.
Well,
and to follow up with that, when does a debt buyer really become if they're just running around buying up the debt and then collecting as a first-party collector, it seems like, you know, that practice could be used to get around the requirement of being registered as a collection agency, essentially.
Sure. Well, in response to your first question, the remedies, I believe, under the Federal Act is solely for third-party collectors. And the Oregon law is much broader, that it also encompasses third and first. And so in that way, your scenario about someone running around buying up debt, that scenario would be covered. A consumer would have remedies under the Oregon Act. They might necessarily have remedies under the Federal Act, but they would have remedies under the Oregon Act.
Thank you.
Representative Widener was next. Representative Widener?
Mine will be quick. How often do we see these cases? I mean, is this something that doesn't sound like it'd be something that'd be very common with the scenario that you gave us in the first description? And I'm wondering, are we opening a can of worms like the chair was getting to, where we're going to let debt collectors just go around and keep buying things up and keep harassing people over and over, and rather than registering as collection agencies the way they should? And that's the thing that scares me a little bit when I'm hearing this. So, because we are in consumer protection, so I think we're supposed to look out for consumers a little bit.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Weiner has asked me about how often this occurs. And as far as the scenario that I presented to you about someone who goes out and takes assignments to assert a claim in litigation, I really can't tell you. In my experience, that's the only experience I've had, although other members of the committee, the practice of purchasing debt or purchasing pre-existing accounts and collecting on those things, it happens every day. As far as I know, especially in bankruptcy, if a bankruptcy trustee has a corporation that has accounts receivable or accounts that are due, there are individual investors who routinely go ahead and they do buy accounts and collect on those things. So this is a very normal part of the credit market, the world of credit. And it's actually a very strong cornerstone of having some kind of liquidity for the credit market. As far as opening a can of worms, I guess I'm trying to make a distinction, and I guess I need to make it a little bit clearer, where the remedies are in two acts that aren't changing, and 697, I understand the concern about those two worlds colliding, but 697 really does affect only the requirement of registration, and I can see where there might be a scenario where you are correct, that if 697's definition would change and there was another exception to collection agencies not registering, where that would be an outcome of changing 697. However, to me, that doesn't seem that wouldn't change the remedies that would be available to consumers. Consumers still have the right to bring an action to, for example, if a collection agency is calling someone, harassing them, calling them 20 minutes on the hour, every hour at midnight. Those are very clear violations of both the Federal Act and of the Oregon Act. And the consumer has the right to bring an action. Well, they have the right to respond accordingly. There's steps to be taken. Something has to be submitted in writing, usually to the collection agency, saying, do not contact me. And once that happens, the collection agency has a one-shot deal to send a written notice back to the consumer saying, I received your notice. I understand you don't want to be contacted. And that's the end of it. And for every subsequent violation, that is something that is the consumer can collect on as a remedy. Those remedies aren't going to change. It's just a matter of whether the consumer knows that they have the rights to those remedies and they go ahead and exercise them. I think that's the real issue. It's the enforcement part of it.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems very clear to me that one of the things that's happening is that there are people who don't want to be collection agencies, but they are. Who buy the debts instead of taking a fee to do the collections, and all they're doing is getting around the licensing and bonding requirements. And I think that's something we need to look at instead of putting this in this piece of legislation. That wasn't a question.
Well, Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, thank you. First of all, this bill makes perfect sense to me, and I think it is a good bill. I think it is actually fairly technical, and indeed, I would think it should be a non-controversial fix. However, I just in my whispers and notes with some of my fellow legislators, I feel there's a fair amount of confusion over this, and I wanted to take a stab. I do not believe that this bill, in any way, shape, or form, will affect consumers' remedies against unfair collection. Debt collection practices in any way. I do think that this, I feel there might be some confusion between the relationship between 646, ORS 646, and 697. And in terms of a first party debt collector, it will obviate the need for them to register under 697. And the reason why that is okay is because ORS 697 is in the registration requirement is not actually to protect the actual consumer, the person against whom the debt is being collected. That's 646. 697 is actually to protect the person who owns the debt and then hires the third party, which is why first party debtors just don't need to be bound by 697. I don't know if that confused it or clarified it in any way, shape, or form.
No, but I understand.
That's what I think this bill is trying to do.
Okay.
Other questions?
Well, I have one then for Representative Barton or
go sit down there.
So I mean, you've made a lot of and I understand that, but and it doesn't change the remedies that are available to the consumer. But I guess that's my question. The remedies that are available to a consumer right now are they can bring an action. And I don't know many people that are in the situation of having debt collected on them. They usually don't have a lot of money to find a go hire a lawyer. And I don't know, Representative Barton, do you do this kind of work pro bono? And
actually, Mr. Chair, in all seriousness, I have done this several times pro bono. This exact, I'm not kidding. I've done this exact. Yeah,
that's why we got this bill.
Oh my God!
You didn't think I had it in me, Mr. Chair, did you? I didn't think I did pro bono work, did you?
I shouldn't have asked you that question. So anyway, well, I think we've. Are there any further questions? I don't know if that one is totally wrap this up or not, but I appreciate your testimony on this bill. I do have someone else signed up for testimony, and we have your contact information, I assume.
Oh, yes.
So we can call you and ask you more questions offline if we have any.
Of course.
Thank you very much. Sybil Hebb.
Some of this stuff is worse than the judiciary, I swear to God. We have a regulation on death practices.
Yes.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Sybil Hebb. I'm with the Oregon Law Center, and as you all know, we represent low-income clients across the state of Oregon. I have only brief comments, and I echo Representative Barton's sort of outlining of the issues, and I appreciate the comment that the chair made. From our perspective, we do agree that as the current law stands, removing the requirement for debt buyers to register, removing them from the definition of collection agency doesn't have much of a practical impact on the current resolutions that are available to consumers. I think we would argue and hope for continued discussion about the concept of whether there ought to be greater regulations or protections for the relationship between the debt buyer and the consumer, and that may be a discussion that would be relevant to this bill, or this bill may be part of that larger discussion, or they could be separate. But I think that sort of those are the two prongs here. The bill by itself doesn't have a whole lot of impact on the current current abilities, but we'd like there to be more. So, thank you.
Thank you, Sybil. I think you articulated the point I was trying to get to. So.
I appreciate the point you made.
I have a question.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Sybil, are you in support of the bill?
Well, Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, I think we initially did not have any objection to the bill because we didn't think it had a substantive impact on, and I think standing alone, we continue to not have an objection. We do hope for discussion around whether there ought to be greater substantive protections for debtors vis-a-vis debt buyers in the collection, and that wouldn't necessarily, I don't know if that would even fit under the relating clause of this particular bill, but it's a policy, it may, I don't remember, but it's a policy decision. We do hear lots of complaints from our clients about the relationship that they have with debt buyers, and there's just a great deal of confusion in that, in those negotiations.
So. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to point out that I also agree that this particular bill has little or no effect on anything. But I wanted to still, bring up the point, and this was the place to do it, I think, about the debt buyers and what I perceive as a lack of regulation, which should be addressed.
I should say, just for the record, I think the consumer debtor creditor section of the bar did feel like there was an advantage to the. I think that they have some thought that there need not be a requirement to register if there's no actual practical benefit to the registration. So I think that may have been, not to speak for them, but I think that may have been the sort of point of it in the first place from that perspective. But I appreciate the larger policy discussion. I hope we can continue to have it. So thank you.
Thank you. Further questions of Sybil? Thank you.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else who would like to comment? Mr. Marquis.
Mr. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey representing the Oregon Collectors Association. I wasn't going to comment on this bill today, but I felt compelled to. I agree with everything that Representative Barton said. This bill in its current state and under the current state of other statutory requirements has very little effect on anything. In fact, Department of Consumer Business Services has always taken the position that debt buyers don't have to be registered as collection agencies anyway. We will have, however, hopefully, if the chair schedules it, legislation or proposed legislation before this committee that would give Department of Consumer Business Services specific statutory authority to enforce violations of the Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act, Oregon version, for collection agencies. And if you go down that, if you decide that's a good idea and decide to do that, you may want to weigh whether you want debt buyers under that same regulatory structure or not. That certainly would change the parameters of this bill. And I would just say that under the, there is a federal version called the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act administered by the Federal Trade Commission, and it specifically regulates third-party debt collectors and exempts first-party debt collectors, but does not exempt debt buyers. They are under the federal act for purposes of the same kind of do's and don'ts. I just thought the committee should have that information. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions or get out of your hair.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm not seeing any questions. Seeing no one else jumping up to testify on House Bill 2307, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2307. Colleagues, we're going to have, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2190. We will not be moving this bill to any sort of work session today, just FYI. We've had a public hearing on this bill previous. We have some amendments, I believe, available that have come forward, and it was my intent to discuss this bill again and to look at the amendments that are in front of us so that we can keep this particular bill on our radar screen. So with that, I have John Powell, and well, before we go there, Victoria, why don't you give us a brief description of the bill first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2190 requires insurer to provide written documentation to support valuation when vehicle is declared a total loss. Requires insurer to pay amount not in dispute when there is disagreement over value of total vehicle. Allows owner of total vehicle to recover reasonable appraisal costs from insurer when appraised value is greater than insurer's final offer.
So that jogs our memories, or helps jog mine a little bit. And I think I'm going to have the department come up first, and Teresa Miller. And Victoria, what before she gets started, we have what amendments in front of us?
We have -2 amendments, -3 amendments, and -4 amendments.
Okay, and I was going to have Ms. Miller speak to the bill in general as it pertains to the amendments as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Teresa Miller, and I am currently the acting administrator at the Insurance Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I think Victoria did a nice job of just reminding the committee a little bit about what the bill does. There are basically three provisions to the bill. The first is that it requires insurers to provide consumers with information explaining the total loss process, as well as how the insurer has valued the vehicle. Secondly, it requires insurers to pay the undisputed amount of the vehicle so that the insurer, so the insured can purchase alternate transportation while negotiations continue. And finally, it encourages insurers to provide fair and accurate settlement offers by requiring insurers to pay reasonable appraisal provisions in cases where the appraisal provision is triggered and the final appraisal decision is greater than the insurer's final offer. The insurance division has been in conversations with not only the insurance lobby, but also all the stakeholders that we work with around this issue for several months now. And as a result of those conversations, we have modified not only, we modified our original proposal, I guess, where we started. And so you see some of the results of those conversations in the actual House bill language in House Bill 2190, but also in the Dash 4 amendments that I'll walk through. In many cases, we were able to accommodate the concerns that we heard from the insurance lobby without compromising sort of the general purpose of the bill. So with that background, I will go ahead and walk through the Dash 4 amendments. We'll start with Section 2. At the request of the industry, rather than requiring insurers to develop the notice to consumers that would discuss the total loss process, the division agreed that we would go ahead and develop that notice. We also broadened the scope of the notice in the amendment, so it clarifies that the total loss notice will include information not only about the total loss process and the vehicle valuation process, but also the duties of the insurer and how consumers can contact the insurance division. The amendment also clarifies that the insurer must provide to both policyholders and third-party owners the valuation or appraisal reports used by the insurer to value the vehicle. Under current law, these reports are only provided to policyholders and only upon the request of the policyholder. In Section 3 of the bill, the amendment removes the requirement that the payment of the undisputed amount be included in the policy. Instead, this requirement will simply be mandated by law. Seems like a minor change, but this will actually save insurers costs of redrafting and reprinting policies, and it'll be the law. The amendment also clarifies that the insurer is not required to pay the undisputed amount until the insured or third-party owner agrees to transfer title of the vehicle. But the amendment also clarifies that payment and receipt of the undisputed amount does not waive the rights of the insured, the insurer, or the third policy, the third-party owner, to negotiate or continue negotiating after they've received that undisputed amount. And I know in talking with some of the members of the committee, some of you have expressed some concern about this provision, so I want to come back and talk a little bit about that in just a minute. Finally, Section 4 of the bill, the amendment removes the requirement, again, that the appraisal provision be included in the policy. The same issue as with the undisputed amount, this requirement would simply be mandated by law for the same reasons. So I want to come back to the title issue just because in talking to some of you, I know there were questions about why we would agree to such a provision. And so I just want to explain that a little bit and why I actually think this is something that's beneficial for consumers. Typically speaking, consumers don't want to keep the damaged vehicle or what we call the salvage. The title transfer is necessary for the insurer to be able to market the salvage. The alternative is for the insurer to deduct the value of the salvage from the undisputed amount, which would mean that the consumer would get a smaller check. So let's take an example. If an insurer values the vehicle before the accident at $5,000 and the salvage is worth $1,000, when they paid that undisputed amount, they would actually pay $4,000 because they would deduct that value of the salvage. And another thing to consider is that during this process, the damaged vehicle is frequently sitting somewhere like in an auto body shop, and it's accruing daily storage fees that can run somewhere between $25 and $30 a day. Once the insurer has made an offer to the insured or third party, the insurer is no longer obligated to pay those storage fees. So this means that the consumer's stuck having to figure out what to do with the salvage. They either have to move it, pay the storage fees, or turn that title over. So the title doesn't really give the consumer much leverage in these negotiations. If anything, it just means that they're going to get a reduced check when they get their undisputed amount, when most of them don't want to keep that salvage anyway. And it means the consumer has the headache of dealing with the salvage and trying to either figure out how to get it moved or paying storage fees. So transfer of the title, I would argue, actually assists in relieving the pressure on the consumer, which, again, was kind of the whole purpose behind the bill. And with that, Mr. Chair, that sort of walks through the Dash 4 amendments. I think, you know, from the division's perspective, we did the best we could to try to get to consensus on this issue. We don't have that, and I know that, but I think we tried to get as far as we could and address as many concerns as we could without sort of compromising some of the major pieces that we wanted to accomplish.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Teresa, for that explanation. That really spelled out for me why this is an okay thing to do.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions of Ms. Miller on this?
Well, I guess I do.
Ms. Comey.
Thank you. So, Teresa, so what if there were a dispute? And I'm thinking in particular of a friend of mine who did have this situation. He had an old car that had been fixed up that was worth a great deal of money to him, but on the Blue Book or however they assess value, because it was an older car and one that hadn't been fixed up, it would not be worth very much money. So then it seems to me that that person would have some investment in not having it just go to a wrecking yard. You would want to keep that the wrecked vehicle available so another appraiser could look at it and look at perhaps that all the money this person had put into it. So I guess just respond to that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, and if this individual wanted to keep the salvage for good, they certainly could do that, and then that amount would just be deducted from any amount that the insurer provided them. If they just wanted to keep it available, under the bill, if you look at the amendment, as I understand it, the amendment actually allows, once the... I'm looking at this.
Tell me what line.
Page 2 of... I'm looking at this. The Dash 4, page 2... And it says, on line 6, an insurer is not obligated to pay the undisputed amount under subsection 1 until the insured or third-party owner of the motor vehicle agrees to execute documents sufficient to transfer ownership of the motor vehicle, authorizes the insurer to move the motor vehicle, and then number 3, after expiration of the 14-day period. So there's actually a 14-day period where that vehicle would be available so they could have an appraiser come take a look at it. Does that answer your question?
Sort of. Thank you.
Ms. Miller, I'm going to see if I can capture a question that Representative Tomei asked, and I don't know if it's quite correct or not, but in her scenario where the insured, you know, has a vintage car or something and decides that, you know, they don't like the offer of the undisputed amount,
mm-hmm.
And don't want to turn over title at that time, and they decide to keep the auto, I'm sure that in here that the insurer is still going to negotiate a loss value with the insured at some point and make that payment down the road. It's not really spelled out clearly, but I think it's sort of implied in here.
Mr. Chair, as I understand our amendment, in that situation, until they wanted to turn over title, the payment of the undisputed amount would be made, but it would be made minus the value of the salvage. So they would still get the amount of that undisputed minus the salvage. So they'd have that at least as negotiations continue.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Appreciate your testimony.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And next up, I'd like John Powell and Steve Merle. hope I said your name right this time. I'm going to get it right one of these years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. And with me is Mr. Merle with State Farm. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we appreciate the explanation of the administrator, and we concur with that amendment that they brought forward and appreciate it very much. The, as you'll recall on this issue, there were really a couple differences between where the industry ended up on this issue and the insurance division. Those were the who pays how much for the appraisal at the end of that process, and whether or not the insurer would pay advance payments to a third party. And the third party issue is probably our most important one from a process standpoint. And the reason we differ is the third party case, you're dealing with a liability issue as opposed to a contractual issue with your first party, with your own insurance company. And so now this is requiring your insurance company to pay something that is your fault, or at least partially your fault, might be comparatively negligent. Maybe you're arguing that you were 85% at fault and the other person was speeding at the same time and partially at fault. And so now you're going to require your insurance company to forward money to that third party who may be suing you. And a liability coverage is simply you as a consumer are in a different position than you are when you're collecting from your own insurance company under a contract. And that insurance company that has agreed under that contract they sold you to defend you in a case like this, and that contract and judicial decisions over the years said, and they have a real fiduciary responsibility to represent you the best that they can. So when you're dealing with a liability situation like this, you're hoping to reach a settlement that everybody can agree to within the policy limits if that's possible. And so that's the difference between the insurance division's approach and our approach. We did have request the Dash 2 amendments be drafted, and the one thing that came out wrong on those was the third-party payment part. It's included in here, and we'd ask that in Section 3 that address only the first party, because we agree with advancing the money to our own insured when there's a dispute over value. So those are the differences. On the appraisal payment, under our provision, and this is something that we are still talking about in terms of what is best for the consumer in this case. As we testified, we think having no skin in the game is going too far. We agree that there should be some limitation on how much the consumer has to pay in the case of an appraisal. That is, it should be worth something other than nothing for them to go through that process. And so we were suggesting that they be limited to $100 in the shared expenses. And I want to be very clear on page 2 of the Dash 2 amendments. This limitation of $100 as written here is of the shared expenses. So they would still, under this amendment, be responsible for their own appraiser's cost. But again, we're flexible on that issue in terms of how much the consumer would pay in that particular situation. As you know, in the divisions bill, if the appraisal process works out in the favor of the person requesting the appraisal, if they better their last offer, they pay nothing. If they don't, then they pay their full cost or their full share of appraisal. So those are kind of where the bill stands and the differences, and we could get our amendment right for a future work session.
Great. Yeah, I got a little note from someone that said that the amendment had trouble, so, you know, I don't have a problem waiting for a more accurate amendment for the committee to review. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand your position on both of those issues, and on the third-party payment, I would like to see this third party, even though he is a third party, have some way to move on. And do you have any suggestions how that could be done other than the department's suggested way?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Riley, I don't know of a way in a liability situation, because many of these are settled very easily and very quickly. In a complex case, I don't know how you move this more rapidly than the system will allow it to move. It is one of the downsides of our system, and you know, determining fault and going through that process.
Follow up. Thank you. What I'm thinking, and I don't know if I'm way off base or if what I'm, my idea has any merit at all, but is there any way to work together with the third party's insurance company to deal with this situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, let me let Mr. Merle answer that question from a claim standpoint.
Yeah, Chair Hovey, Representative Riley, it's difficult to craft a legislative solution. That what you're talking about, though, happens...
Steve, could you identify yourself for the record?
Steve Merle, I'm an attorney with State Farm Insurance, the claim department. It's very difficult to craft a legislative solution. What you would hope is that there are several coverages you buy in insurance policy. Liability protects you against claims of other people, and that's what we're talking about here. What you would hope that people also have is their own first-party physical damage coverage, where if there is a dispute or if there is a delay, they go back to their own insurance company and say, hey, you take care of it for me, and go after the liable party and let them fight out. And that happens regularly. Mm-hmm. The rub comes when a person doesn't, for whatever reason, carry that optional physical damage coverage.
Okay.
Yeah. Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for either of you, and it's regarding the first-party, third-party distinction you made. And I have actually, based on the testimony in the last hearing, I've actually thought about this a fair amount. And I don't see it. I don't see the significance. And I truly don't understand, but I want to understand. And I believe the distinction you're making, I'm going to repeat back to you what I think you're telling me, and if I'm wrong, please let me know, is that in a third-party context, being that if this bill, as say -4 amendment, were to pass, mm-hmm. the insurance company, on behalf of the first party insurer, would have to pay the undisputed total loss of say the victim, in this case the third party, and that would decrease the I suppose in the subsequent negligence action essentially the insurance company on behalf of the first party's leverage to negotiate a total settlement. Is that essentially the problem? Because I believe that is indeed the explicit purpose of the bill. Is there anything wrong with that?
Chair Holy, Representative Barton, I think you've got part of it, but if I could...
What am I missing, please?
Yeah, if I could just back up, just kind of... I want to kind of give it the scope some context, and I don't want to... I want to answer your question.
Yeah.
When you buy an insurance policy, you buy a bundle of protections. One of them is liability coverage, which protects you from third parties. The other one is a number of first-party coverages, but what we're talking about here is physical damage coverages to the car, just to kind of keep minimize the amount of things we're talking about. In the third-party context, what you're buying from me as a consumer, what you want from me, are two things. Is when you owe an accident, it's your fault or allegedly your fault. You want me to go out and to try to settle those claims. If that can't happen, you also want me to defend those claims. And you want me to do that in the best possible way that I can. if I, like the Dash 4 amendments propose, end up dealing with a third party who has a claim against you and we can't reach an agreement that this claim is going to be resolved when I pay them, they can still sue you. Now, two bad things out of that. One is, if I happen to have paid my limit for property damage, if it's a property damage only claim, and I paid my limit out, my duty to defend you is now discharged. You're on your own. So that deficiency that the person sues you for, which may or may not be owed, is now your responsibility to defend out of your own pocket. And that could pretty quickly drain your life savings doing that. That's the bad effect that that has. The other bad effect is, I may have paid so much money, even if I didn't pay my limit, that now I don't have enough money left as an insurance company to motivate settlement without you coming up with funds on your own. That was the case that I put into the evidence last time, where Justice Gillette said that, that's a negligent act on behalf of an insurance company. Now, if you put that in the statute, it's not going to be a negligent act, but the same bad things that the court said we shouldn't do that for come up. So that's the third-party situation. That's why we're opposed to that. Now, I can differentiate for you what happens with a first-party situation and why it's better to advance pay in a first-party situation.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I ask a follow-up question on the third-party matter. I think I've got the first party. So for, is there a statutory minimum for what the policy limits would be in a, say, an auto context, which is a hypo?
Yeah. Chair Hovey and Representative Barton, there is. And today it's $10,000. State Farm, I'm a preferred insurer. I see very few people in our book of business that have that kind of limit, but I still see this problem.
And one more, if I may. But correct me if I'm wrong, but this bill, the Dash 4, according to the Dash 4 amendments, would not in any way, shape, or form affect your duty or your obligations to the insured.
Chair Holby, Representative Barton, that's not quite accurate, because if I end up paying my limit, which I wouldn't do today, then my defense obligation is discharged. And this bill would compel me to do that. Today, I won't pay my limit until I get resolution for you, and I continue to have the defense obligation as long as I have the money still in my hands.
Representative Widener.
You're kind of getting to the point that I kind of highlighted here in Section 2, and I've had lots of talks with Teresa and others around this and was trying to get a handle on it. But after I talked with her last, I got thinking about it, and you hit on the key. For me, if someone hit my car, hey, refund me for my car, and I would never settle. I would drag this thing out with a third party, and I think that's what you're worried about, because I know consumers, once they figure that out, they're going to be on it real fast, and it'll get through the community real quick that they can do that. And that's what you're trying to protect against, if I'm correct.
Yeah, Chair Hovey, Representative Whitener, that's exactly the issue we're concerned about.
Yeah, thank you.
Other questions?
I have a question.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So how often does that happen?
Chair Hovey, Representative Tomei, I don't have specific numbers. I know that it's enough that it... I see it happen from time to time. I see it at least a couple times a year. So it's not a big problem unless you're the person it happens to.
Unless you're the first party, not the third party. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying the third party. Well, if you're the insured and you run out of limits, in today's world, if you don't have enough limits, I still defend you and I can take care of you. And we have some of those cases that do happen from time to time. But in today's world, without the obligation to advance pay that third party, I'm able to take better care of you. This bill would undermine my ability to do that, the way the dashboards are currently drafted.
Representative Riley.
I'd like to ask a question of Representative Barton.
Doug, you had it.
You don't have to allow
anything.
I'd be
all
honored.
I want to know is, did I answer your question? Did you get it?
No.
Representative Riley, Mr. Chair, yes, I do think I understand. I am planning to support the Dash 4 amendments, and I am planning to vote for the bill as according to the Dash 4 amendments.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Tomei.
I'm going to pursue this. Thank you. I'm insured by State Farm, and I was hit by someone. And I'm just trying to apply all of that I'm hearing from you to my situation. how would I be damaged if we had passed this bill with the Dash 4 amendment?
Yeah. Chair Hovey, Representative Tomei, the only way that you would have been damaged if you passed the Dash 4 amendments is if you hit a car or caused property damage that was enough that you had a problem with how much your coverage
was. I was hit. I was not hit.
You were hit. You were hit? Okay. If you had your own collision coverage, which I'm assuming you have physical damage coverage, the only thing this bill would have done statutorily is it would have required us to pay you the undisputed amount if we couldn't come to an agreement on settlement, which is State Farm's policy today before this bill. So I don't know, as a first-party person, if you were hit and it's not your fault, that you would come out any differently under how we handle claims.
So what if I were the hit, if I may, Mr. Chair? Oh, so what please. If I were the hitter?
If you were the hitter, Chair Hovey and Representative Tomei, what may have happened to you is if they caused so much damage that it's starting to cause a problem with your limits, and the undisputed amount turns out to be within the amount of damage you cause, now as an insurer, I would have to pay that undisputed amount, but I wouldn't have resolution of the claim. And now you could still be sued, but you wouldn't have any defense that would be paid for you.
Follow up. So I'm the one responsible. So if my limit is paid out, then I'm responsible for what else I would be sued for, correct?
Chair Hovey, Representative Tomei, you're responsible if they prove that claim, yes. And one of the issues is it may not all be owed what they're claiming is owed, and that's why you want to have that defense available to you, because you want to narrow down to what you actually do owe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just want to make sure I understand this. Under the current law, if I have a $10,000 limit and I do something over $10,000 worth of damage, even though it's going to cost you as an insurance company to defend me and to pay out, you're going to do that because I don't reach the limit till you make the settlement. Is that what I'm hearing?
Chair Hovey, Representative Wingard, that's correct.
So I end up not paying anything for you to defend me, but then once you settle, if it's more than the $10,000, I'm on the hook for the difference there, right?
Right, you're okay. On the hook for the, and I can spend $20,000 maybe defending you.
But I don't have to pay those fees.
I pay all that.
Okay, now under the bill as the law would change, if I did more than $10,000 worth of damage, and at least $10,000 of that were undisputed, and you paid that out, now I no longer have all that basic free legal defense service that you're talking about, where I have to go out and fight off the rest of it.
That's absolutely correct, and that's what our problem is with that issue.
Thank you very much.
Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. I was hoping this discussion would help clarify the issue a little more, and I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next up, I have Monty King.
I agree. This is worse than judiciary.
Oh man, it hurt my feelings.
What school of origami did you go to?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Monty King. I'm representing the Auto Appraisers of Oregon, also Oregon Vehicle Dealers, Oregon Power Sports Association. I talked with the president of the Appraiser Association this morning. He was all in support of the Dash 4. However, we'd like to point out that last session, the legislature passed a bill requiring people who appraise vehicles for compensation to be certified as appraisers. There were two exemptions, auto dealers who were licensed and employees of insurance companies who appraised those vehicles. We feel that if there's going to be more amendments on this, we'd like to see anybody who's involved in these disputes be certified, not exempted. We feel the best should be there, especially if the dispute goes farther. A couple things, I've been listening to the debate. We talked a lot about last session about guidebooks. Kelley Blue Book in December has decided they're going to, at the request of insurance companies and banks, they're going to value all vehicles every single week. I had dealers calling me. They lost $150,000 worth of inventory in 1 week because they were using a November 1st book for value, and then all of a sudden a December 15th book, and everything had gone down that far. They lost that much money in value, which when you're talking about flooring kind of hurts. The insurance companies last session said that Blue Book, Kelley Blue Book, and Black Book, and Red Book, and Native Book, and all these books that dealers use and banks use for sending out loans weren't worth anything. We still think they are. The money where people are paid on their cars after they're injured, the biggest thing is, what can they buy? They need to go to work the next day or 2 days or 4 days from now. It's not about how long it takes. It's about how fast can I get the money to buy something so I can get to work. Why is it important to dealers? Because if the dealers can't get a good price for their vehicle so they can make a little profit, then they can't sell the car. And the people who get a deficient insurance settlement, they can't buy the car that they really should get. Now, I've been injured too. I got T-boned down at Corvallis. I had a Bronco 2 that was worth about $9,500. They offered $6,700 on it. And I worked for Auto Trader right then. I could find all the Bronco 2s I wanted. Not single one, not one anywhere in the western region was for $6,700. The reason they offered $6,700 was because they knew I probably would have to take it so I could go buy something really fast so I could get to work. Well, fortunately, I had enough money where I didn't do that, and 9 months later, they finally settled. And with everything, they paid about $23,000, plus their lawyer fees. But I was a very lucky person. The appraisers in the state are really good. We have some very excellent people. Gary Peterson, been doing it for years. He did three evaluations yesterday. Auto appraisers are very experienced, the ones that were seniors. We've done actually classes on appraising, and I went through the class 4 hours. I learned more about cars than I learned in the last 10 years. It's very interesting stuff. A good appraisal for a vehicle will cost more than $100. A top appraiser, depending on the vehicle, might be a classic. I know Gary Peterson told me he did a 57 Chevy Corvette the other day. And if it had been down in Arizona, the big auction would be $135,000. He appraises $85,000 because he's not. The guy said, well, you're not at an auction, so you're not going to have all those people who really want that car. So if there's no money for the appraisers, nobody's going to get an appraiser, and they're not going to be able to enforce their rights to get the right value for their vehicle. I can answer any questions if you want.
Questions? Monty, I have a question for you. I'm just kind of curious, since we dealt with appraisals last year, I'm just wondering the connection between this bill and the issue that you're bringing up. It seems like it's a different issue, and it's already dealt with in another part of the statute.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe it has been finished out at all. I think the values that the insurance companies are offering people for their wrecked vehicles so that they can replace them are severely deficient. And when they get that money and go to the dealer, they can't get what they were driving. They're going to have to go way down in quality, whatever. But at least with this bill, the insurance company isn't going to be able to hold them up. They're at least going to get some money so they can maybe go out and make a down payment on the vehicles they want and then have enough time to work the problem out with the insurance company and the other people involved with appraisers and get the true values of their vehicle. What's happening now is if you don't agree in 2 or 3 or 4 days, you're going to lose your job. And it's just as simple as that. And we don't want to see people lose their job because they can't get a car because somebody else ran them off the road. You know, the valuations aren't there. If you know, what happens, at least they're going to get the undisputed value, and they can go down and make some kind of a deal at that on that, and then get the real value hopefully at a later point. So,
all right. Any other questions? Thank you. I keep going back and forth. Everybody's pointing. Do you have a question? You're pointing this way, and somebody's pointing this way. So, I'll represent Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, just a question, really, for you, Mr. Chair. Do you think it'd be all right, as long as we have the department in the room, to see if we're going to go ahead with other amendments? Are they okay with this change to acknowledge licensed when we use the word appraiser in future amendments? Make sure that they're okay with that while they're here.
Certified.
Certified, yeah, same thing.
Well, we if you'd wish them to come up and answer that question, we can do that. Thank you, Mr. King. Ms. Miller?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Teresa Miller, Acting Administrator at the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The issue that Mr. King just raised is not an issue that is actually addressed in the bill, and it's not one that was a part of the conversation that we've had with stakeholders. So, in my mind, it's a bit of a separate discussion. I don't know how the stakeholders that we've talked to would feel about this, but everything that we've done in our bill has been a part of a long conversation with many, many folks who are interested in this issue, and this just hasn't been an issue that we've talked about. So, is that helpful?
Questions? Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to comment on Representative Gilliam's question? Don't see anybody jumping up to comment on that piece. No one else? Anyone else would like to testify? Seeing nobody jumping up, I assume not. Anything else from the committee? That committee, it'll be my intention to roll this carry over this bill until Monday.
Freudian slip.
So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2190. Committee, we will not be meeting on Friday, so enjoy your Friday.
I would be here. I could have been here all evening with you.
And
I'm going to miss it.
Sure, Hobie's wonderful. And I appreciate you sticking it out. I'm not as sure our calendar looks like Fridays in the future may be in jeopardy after this Friday, but I can't speak to that exactly right now. So, appreciate it, and see you Friday. With that, I adjourn the Committee on Consumer Protection.